WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a civic media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A federal judge has agreed to issue a temporary restraining order blocking Elon Musk's government efficiency team access to Treasury Department payment systems because of the risk of disclosure of sensitive and confidential information. And a federal judge blocking the Trump administration's plans to put thousands of workers at USAID on leave and reinstating hundreds who've already been removed.
At stake when it comes to an agency like USAID are millions of people around the world who rely on that federal agency, that relief agency, for desperately needed food and medicine. So the stakes here are high as this plays out in the legal system.
ABC Selena Wang. The bodies of those on a passenger plane that went missing in Alaska now found on sea ice, along with the wreckage of the plane about 34 miles southeast of Nome, where it was supposed to land. All 10 people on board believed to be dead. And Hamas releasing a new round of hostages, three more after 15 months in captivity. This is ABC News. There is an urgent search for answers after a deadly plane crash in Alaska. All 10 bodies of those on board recovered on the ice field where the plane crashed off Nome. ABC's Jacqueline Lee has more.
The NTSB is now investigating this third major aviation incident in just over a week. In Washington, D.C. last Wednesday, 67 people were killed in that mid-air crash involving an Army Black Hawk helicopter and American Airlines flight. And last Friday, a fiery inferno in Philadelphia when a medical transport jet crashed, killing seven people.
Police in the Bahamas say two women who they describe as American residents were injured in a shark attack yesterday evening. The two women were airlifted to a hospital in the Bahamas. One of them is in serious condition, according to the police. And there's a bet between Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, where the Eagles are from, with Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe, home state of the Chiefs on tomorrow's Super Bowl. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Are you 50 or older? This news is for you. The CDC now recommends you get vaccinated against pneumococcal pneumonia. Even if you're healthy, your age puts you at risk. People 50 or older are over six times more likely to be hospitalized with pneumococcal pneumonia compared to adults 18 to 49. Just one shot can help protect you. Learn more and schedule at VaxAssist.com. That's VaxAssist.com. Sponsored by Pfizer.
Hey, it's Amanda with another new WISCO 411. And the diverse and resilient Appleton Room to Be Safe is hosting a monthly drop-in night for LGBTQ plus adults, which will have social connection, fun, and resource sharing, and best of all, support. These meetings are available once a month from now through April. They are completely free and unstructured, so you can come when you want and leave when you want. If you're interested, go to WGBW.FM and click events to learn more.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.FM.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. All over the country, people protested the early moves of the Trump administration over the last week. That includes here in Wisconsin at the state capitol. Mike Moen reports.
Trump's return to the White House has involved a heavy dose of controversial executive orders. And access granted to wealthy advisor Elon Musk is raising legal and ethical questions as he looks to drastically cut budgets for federal agencies, or in some cases, eliminate them. Dozens of protesters gathered at designated sites in the Midwest. Organizer Kelsey Brienne said her event was a response to an attempted blitz by Trump against the government he oversees.
It's exhausting. These executive orders are not in any way normal.
Trump's moves include revoking affirmative action policies and withdrawing the U.S. from the World Health Organization. The demonstrations, billed as peaceful grassroots events, were described as frustration over the lack of influential voices trying to intervene, including Democratic leaders. However, some orders have been met with lawsuits. On his social media platform, Musk has defended his work, citing the need to cut government waste. Backlash against the right-wing policy blueprint, known as Project 2025, was another common theme at these rallies. Brienne says in Michigan, they fielded requests from many rural residents to attend. She was encouraged to hear companion protests in states with mostly rural settings, suggesting it's not an easy decision in regions where Trump is deeply popular.
You know, that takes guts, that takes courage, and right now what we need is courage.
But she says it's not easy for a lot of people to keep up with what's happening, prompting folks like her to draw attention to any actions deemed alarming. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Green Bay area weather. I'm Corey Hartman. Snow today could be heavy at times. Another 4 or 5 inches possible. Highs near 27. Snow tapers to flurries tonight, a low around 9. Sunshine and 18 for Sunday. Sunshine on Monday and a high near 21. Mid-teens on Tuesday.
It's 24 right now.
Max Inc. has a super show this weekend. Join us as we welcome The Flavor That Kills, Rob Dees and the Steepwater Band. Plus, we'll talk weather with Rippyology. Saturday and Sunday evening at 6, it's Max Inc. on Civic Media. We are local music.
From Ashwaubenon to Alloway, this is 97.9 WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
From the rolling bluffs of the Driftless region to the pristine shorelines of Superior in Michigan, from the Northwoods to the Kettle Moraine, Civic Media broadcasts across all of Wisconsin.
For all of Wisconsin.
Take a trip with us across the radio network to hear from communities throughout the state. This is the Civic Media Spotlight.
First up on the Spotlight this week, we'll go to the Todd Alba Show. With Donald Trump trying to do away with USAID completely, Todd talks about some personal experience he's had with USAID and the lifelong friends that he's made in Central Africa through the programs from that agency.
Live from the Civic Media World Headquarters in Madison, Wisconsin, it's the Todd Alba Show. And now, pursuing truth wherever it may lead, here's your host, Todd Alba.
Across Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network and streaming worldwide on the Civic Media app. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Todd Alba, along with the fantastic producer, Mr. Aaron Zommers, on the board. It is 6 past the hour of 12 noon on this Monday, February 3rd, 2025. It is a great day to be a Wisconsinite. A little drizzly, a little wet here in the capital city in downtown Madison at the World Headquarters. But Mr. Zommers, all in all, no ice, at least here, we understand, in parts of the state, around Highway 29, Eau Claire to Green Bay, some accumulating snows up there overnight, and then possibly some icy roads in parts of central Wisconsin, although as it warms up, that will become less of an issue throughout the day, some fog in the southern part of the state. So maybe not the cold, but nonetheless, this is the kind of weather I don't like, that kind of in-between stuff.
Yeah, especially once it starts to get a little bit later and we get more of this and it piles up, and then the state just turns brown.
Right, exactly.
It's all mud.
Well, that's a pretty good analogy, Zommers, as we start the week here, back to school, back to work on a Monday. Hope you had a fantastic weekend. Things just turning brown into muck. We'll get into that in a minute. We're also, later on the show, want to carve out some time. Did you watch the Grammys last night, Zommers?
I did not.
I watched them last night on the old CBS, and for the most part, was a fantastic occurrence, as it always is. Lots of great performances, some that just blew me away. I think my favorite performance last night was Bruno Mars and Lady Gaga, who I did not recognize at first because of her wig and her costume. As Letterman used to say, they blew the dump off the place. It was a fantastic performance. They actually won a Grammy last night for one of their songs or albums last night. So big night for them. Beyonce finally got the Album of the Year award for Carter, Cowboy, whatever it's called.
Cowboy Carter.
Thank you. That one. So she walks away a big winner. Lots of other winners last night. So we'll review the Grammys a little bit. It was a good, and they raised a lot, millions and millions of dollars last night for the LA Fire Fund out there as well. Trevor Noah doing a great job as the MC on the Grammys last night. So took that in a little bit. But lots of news to get to. Going to talk a little bit about this trade war. Look at history. See what the conservative history has to say on all this. Also going to take a look, by the way, are you a good Lutheran? Lutherans, listen up, because Lutheran Services is now in the crosshairs of the new Trump administration. defunding them. We'll talk a little bit about that. Seems to be counterintuitive to Christianity, but we'll discuss that a little bit. God love Josh Shapiro, by the way, the governor of Pennsylvania, standing up to the far left on the important issues of the day. Groundhog, one of my favorite holidays, Amers, over the weekend. We missed it. We didn't talk about it. So it was yesterday, Groundhog Day. Now, here in Wisconsin, in Sun Prairie, just outside of Madison, the resident Wisconsin groundhog, Jimmy the groundhog.
I was going to say Jimmy.
Jimmy did not see his shadow, and therefore spring will be early in Wisconsin. Not the case out in Pennsylvania. Punxsutawney Phil predicted 6 more weeks of winter. And Josh Shapiro, the governor, God love him, he's not having anything to do with this cake predicting stuff. He is standing up for groundhogs. I love it. We'll hear from him a little bit later in the show. Meanwhile, on a more serious note for Democrats, Wisconsin's Ben Wickler, chairman of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, endorsed by former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, endorsed by current Democratic House Leader Hakeem Jeffries, endorsed by Democratic U.S. Senate Leader Chuck Schumer, lost the race for DNC chair. The National Democrats seemingly took a left turn, Clyde. they put this my least favorite Martin guy from Minnesota in, and they also put in David Boss Hogg from Florida. This kid, the kid from Florida who came up and did door to door for Wisconsin Democrats in rural Wisconsin in a suit and dress shoes. So very relatable.
Indeed.
So Democrats seem to be well on their way to staying in the minority nationally. The upside is that Ben Wickler stays in Wisconsin, which could put the Wisconsin State Supreme Court race here in a few weeks back in play. Because it hasn't been getting a lot of play. And Schimmel, in my opinion, is if the election were held today, Schimmel would win. But I think maybe Susan Crawford now has a chance against Schimmel, because Democrats are actually going to start in Wisconsin focusing back on that. And nobody's better at that than Ben Wickler.
It's true.
So, thank you. I appreciate that. So there you go. And we haven't even scratched. I told Zomers we could do 4 hours today.
Oh, easily.
So much to do. But I want to put this in a context that, look, I'm nothing special. I'm just a kid from Richland Center, you understand, in southwest Wisconsin. But I've been blessed and fortunate enough to have a few opportunities in life. And we're going to get to some of the actual news stories of what's going on over the weekend and some of the clips for you to hear. But I thought maybe the best way to start this whole thing out today is with a story, with a personal story to kind of contextualize this, because we all view things differently, right? And that's fine. That's a beautiful thing. And I want you to understand for the rest of the show how I come at this. And they say a picture is worth a thousand words. I have not shown this to Zomers yet this morning. I took this off my wall at home and brought it in. Here we go. For those people watching on the stream on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, there he is back when... Back when Todd had a full head of hair, a dark head of hair, actually. So there's the photo of me suited up in a full head of hair and what I called my porn mustache.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Back in my 20s, along with my friend Silas, originally from El Salvador. And we're standing there in the office of the U.S. Ambassador, Ann Patterson, U.S. Ambassador to El Salvador at the time, in the Salvadoran embassy. And this is back when I was working in my 20s for former U.S. Congressman Scott Klug, Republican. And I was down there for a couple reasons. A, for those regular listeners of the show know, I have been to El Salvador 39 times over 25 plus years. So I know the country fairly well. This was one of my earlier trips. And I went down there for both pleasure to see my friend Silas and also to do a little foreign trade mission, as we say. I went down there, we met with Ann Patterson, and we said, you know, Wisconsin, Ambassador, makes a lot of cheese. And one, governor's hometown, Plymouth, Wisconsin, hometown of Sargento cheese. And we said, you know, not just Sargento, but there's a lot of other great cheese makers in Wisconsin. And don't you know that Salvadorans love cheese? And they make some wonderful cheeses there in El Salvador. But why don't we make it a little bit easier, see if we can get some Binnis, from Bemis for our cheese producers in Wisconsin and sell it in El Salvador. This is after, of course, former then Governor Tommy Thompson, Republican, said, you know what? You know, Wisconsin has so many great things. We need to do a better job of helping our producers in Wisconsin, our ag producers and business producers. Why don't we open up trade offices in Mexico and Germany? And I believe there was one in either Japan or China at the time as well. So Wisconsin had our own trade office in Mexico, which also dealt with some of the Central American countries. Because look, I get it. I've said it on this show before. Today's iteration of Tommy Thompson, unfortunately, is different than the 1990s version of Tommy Thompson. But I'm going to set that aside for purposes of this story for a second. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, people you might disagree with today, it doesn't disqualify what they did 25 years ago that was helpful and good. So Tommy opened up these trade offices in Mexico and Germany, and I said it was either China or Japan. And we're already reaching out to people in the Western Hemisphere and beyond. So I'm there with my buddy Steelis, a native Salvadoran. And look, it wasn't just me. There was a lot of other people that helped out on this. But Sargento, if you go to El Salvador today, you see Sargento cheese. You see other Wisconsin cheese producers being sold in, places like Don Juan. There's a market chain called Don Juan in El Salvador. So that's the context I come to this. As someone who's actually helped out with some business in Central America via foreign trade. Then one of the key agencies to help out with this was USAID, United States Agency for International Development. All right. So let's go back to this photo here for a second, my buddy Steelis. I've told a portion of this story. I'm going to start it here. We'll finish it on the other side. So as a kid, a white kid growing up in 98%, 99% white in the 70s and 80s in Southwest Wisconsin, you didn't have a lot of exposure to people that look different than you. And in the mid-80s, late 80s, there a U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, Republican Bob Caston, said, you know what, we're taking a lot of money, U.S. taxpayer money, and we're putting it into the Defense Department to fight a full war in Central America with the then Soviet Union. Maybe if we want democracy to take hold in Central America and to stymie some of the quote-unquote illegal immigration coming to the U.S., maybe we should make life better in Central America so people want to stay there. So why don't we take a portion of this money that we're sending to in defense and putting into military? Why don't we take a portion of that and create scholarships for kids from low-income families, poverty-ridden families that do very, very well academically, and bring them here to the U.S. and give them a full ride for 2 years, have associate's degrees in business and computer science with the requirement that they go back home for at least 2 years and help from within, grow the economy, make it more stable for democracy. That program was administered through the U.S. Department for Agency of International Development. Through Georgetown University, vis-a-vis the University of Wisconsin, to particularly two-year universities. The connection that was made was life-changing. I'll tell you how when we come back. It's the Todd Allball Show for a Monday on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Todd Allball Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekdays from noon till 2. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
What's your go-to when the cold winds of winter blow? A heavy coat? A hat? For many of us, it's lip stuff, too. But did you know one of the most popular brands, CarMex, the one in the little yellow tube or tub, is a Wisconsin product? It's made in Franklin, a suburb of Milwaukee, and it's shipped to more than 60 countries every year. So can you guess the original use for CarMax? Fixing squeaky doors, actual lip balm, or to soften baseball gloves? The answer coming up. Alfred Woolwig created CarMax in the kitchen of his Dodge County home in Rubicon in 1937. He hand-poured thousands of jars until deciding to automate the manufacturing process in the 70s. Now, can you guess the original use for CarMax when it was created more than 80 years ago? It's always been meant to be a lip balm, but people use it on other dry or itchy skin areas too. It remains a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Next up on the Civic Media Spotlight, we go to Matt Nair on air. Jane, Greg, and Cal welcomed on Darren Von Ruden, president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union, to give the audience an update on what's going on in the world of agriculture. This is part one of a two-part interview, and in part two, Darren talks about how the government always has thoughts on how to make the country run better. He believes maybe they should take their own advice.
Good morning. Welcome back to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, and the Board Lord coming to you from our studio here at Radio Park in Racine. You can always join us. Call or text at 855-752-4842. You can leave a comment if you're watching on the live stream, on Facebook, YouTube, or the platform shedding more viewers, users than a husky blowing its winter coat. Our guest at this time is Darren Von Ruden. He is the president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Before the break, we were talking about the ramifications of executive orders coming out of the Oval Office under Donald Trump and the impact it's already having on Wisconsin farmers. Darren, the languishing, which continues to, we need a new word for languishing farm bill. What are your hopes that this thing is ever going to get passed, or should we just forget about it?
Good question. Back in January, National Farmers Union's executive committee was in D.C., and we visited the four pillars, as we call them, of the Ag Committee. So the Senate chair of the Ag Committee and the ranking member, and then the House of Representatives chair and the ranking member there, too. Everybody was saying, let's get this done sooner than later. Positive words coming out of the House of Representatives in, I'm forgetting his name now, J.T. Thompson, said he really wants to get it on the floor by the middle of March to the end of March at the latest. I really think with all the executive orders and everything else that's going to have to take place over the next month and a half here now, that timeline probably is not going to happen. And then, of course, with on the Senate side, with all the confirmation hearings, which they're fairly good on schedule there, but that body said it probably wouldn't happen until June or July at the earliest. So we're looking at probably a September timeframe, and then whether or not it actually gets to the floor and gets some action, or if it gets another one-year extension, is only to be determined at this time.
So what does this do to farmers in Wisconsin? They're just in a constant holding pattern.
Yep. You know, right now, you know, the programs are still in place because of the extensions. There's some of them programs that haven't been really well liked, and that's why farmers want to see a different farm bill to get something different that would be a little bit better for the farm community and the consumer community alike. And so by just having extension after extension, it's just continuing to foster that get bigger, get out mentality that the farm bill has become. And, you know, we really need to look at how do we refine that and make sure that we're keeping a good, adequate supply of food, but also a very diverse supply of that food too. And what I mean by that is making sure that we have millions of producers rather than 5 or 10,000 producers across the country.
I've never understood the go big or go home argument. That it just doesn't seem a healthy way to, it just doesn't seem healthy.
Yeah, you know, it's all in that efficiency mindset and the the capitalistic society that we live in, where there's only going to be one provider at the end of the day. And, you know, that just really isn't good for any of us. And, you know, you don't have to call it communism or socialism or anything else like that. It's just good common sense to have a very diverse portfolio. And I know any business that I've been a part of or know of, they like to get their products from many different sources versus becoming a 70% dependent on one supplier or one buyer, because your day can be ruined in a heartbeat by that one company.
Isn't that the basis of capitalism, is healthy competition? Or I don't know. I'm not that smart. I've been several texters have told me that. So I'm just assuming that, yeah, I thought competition was good for capitalism.
It should be, you know, and looking at what's happened over the years, you know, the less competition we get, the faster that farmers go out of business and the higher that our food prices get. You know, if this idea of large economics of scale operations were going to make food cheap, we should be paying $1 a gallon for milk instead of $4 a gallon.
Absolutely.
Yep.
That's a great point. Yep. It really is.
And I want to reiterate for folks who don't know or listening to us for the first time, when we're talking about the farm bill, this was a bill that was supposed to be passed in 2023. This was supposed to be done nearly 2 years ago, and they kicked it down the can. They kicked the can down the road in fall of 2023 and said, we'll come back to it next year. And now next year, and Darren, I was listening to Pam Yonke's farm report this morning, which you can listen to 5 to 6 a.m.
She's fabulous.
She's wonderful. But she was talking to one of her reporters, and they're saying, don't be surprised that they try to make it pan out in 2026. And this just goes back to the idea that, man, Darren, they love you. They love the farmer. That farmer, you're the backbone of America. You keep the food rolling, and you're everything they love about America. But the moment that you need something from them, we'd love to help you. We got to go big or go home. I don't even know what that means, honestly. But I've never turned an assignment in 2 years late.
Yep. And, you know, and they always talk about people that don't want to work, and we need to stop these programs to help the disadvantaged folks across the country. But yet, who's not getting their job done?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, they've actually got a job. They're getting paid for it, but they still can't do it. And, you know, and that leads to another thing with the international food aid programs that are on hold right now, too. You know, all that food is going to at some point in time affect the price that farmers pay, because that's part of the supply chain. It's not the hugest part, but it's a good part of the supply chain. And so when that food gets backed up in our docks because it can't go overseas to help the people that really need it, that's going to lower farmers' pay prices. And the real ethical thing on my part is, you know, we're a country of surplus. We have plenty of food. And when we are going to force people into starvation because we can't spend a few extra dollars or pennies, it's just, it's not the same values that most farmers have across this country.
Darren Von Ruden is the president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. He's joining us now on the first Wednesday of every month. Thank you so very much, Darren. It's so important that we hear from farmers and understand what's going on the ground here in Wisconsin. So we really appreciate you taking time for us.
Yep, no problem, Jane. And if I could just say one last thing, call your elected representatives and tell them that they need to stick up for the American farmer and the American consumer.
MyVote.WI.gov. That gives you all the numbers you need. News coming up next. Stay close. You are listening to Matt and Aaron on air on the statewide, countrywide. If you got the app, we are global, baby. Civic Media Radio Network.
Matt and Air on Air is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekday mornings from 10 till noon. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Maggie Dawn Show. ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A federal judge has agreed to issue a temporary restraining order blocking Elon Musk's government efficiency team access to Treasury Department payment systems because of the risk of disclosure of sensitive and confidential information. And a federal judge blocking the Trump administration's plans to put thousands of workers at USAID on leave and reinstating hundreds who've already been removed.
At stake when it comes to an agency like USAID are millions of people around the world who rely on that federal agency, that relief agency, for desperately needed food and medicine. So the stakes here are high as this plays out in the legal system.
ABC Selena Wang. The bodies of those on a passenger plane that went missing in Alaska now found down on sea ice, along with the wreckage of the plane about 34 miles southeast of Nome, where it was supposed to land. All 10 people on board believed to be dead. And Hamas releasing a new round of hostages, three more after 15 months in captivity. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Super Bowl 59 coming up tomorrow night. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Eagles and the Chiefs spending time with family and friends before tomorrow night's Super Bowl here in New Orleans. Kickoff at 5:30. Chiefs tight end Travis Kelce on what he likes to do the night before the game.
I really don't have too many crazy routines. I really just show up to the game ready to play some football and ready to go, you know, all out for the guys that I'm playing with.
NBA, the Bucks losing in Atlanta last night, 115-110. Doc Rivers upset with what he called a casual effort by his team in the third quarter.
It would have been a joke to basketball if we win the game tonight. We didn't deserve it. We didn't deserve to win. We're a better team than what we showed, and it's on me. I got to get them to see it. It's on me. I got to get them to see that you can't be casual in an NBA game and think you're going to win the game.
That's the Bucks' Doc Rivers. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Green Bay area weather. I'm Corey Hartman. Snow today could be heavy at times. Another 4 or 5 inches possible. Highs near 27. Snow tapers to flurries tonight, a low around 9. Sunshine and 18 for Sunday. Sunshine on Monday and a high near 21. Mid-teens on Tuesday.
It's 24 right now.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A New Hampshire Senate bill just killed in committee would have moved the state's 4 presidential electoral votes to a winner-by-district system from a winner-take-all. Nebraska, the only state besides Maine which apportions its electoral votes by district, is trying to end it. The National Conference of State Legislatures defines a winner-take-all system as one where the winning candidate's party, no matter the margin of victory, gets all of the electoral votes. Currently in Nebraska, which has 5 electoral votes, and Maine, which has 4, 1 electoral vote is awarded for each congressional district a candidate wins, and the candidate who wins the popular vote statewide gets the rest. New Hampshire is currently a winner-take-all state with 2 congressional districts. SB 11 would have adopted the Nebraska and Maine model, likely in anticipation of gerrymandering a guaranteed GOP congressional district. But February 5th, the Senate Election and Municipal Affairs Committee recommended that it be killed in an upcoming full Senate vote. The AP reports that Nebraska's GOP is irritated that candidates Obama, Biden, and Harris won an electoral vote from Greater Omaha's Congressional District 2. Another legislative attempt to end it appears doomed to fail by filibuster, so state Republicans are preparing a ballot measure instead, hoping the voters will change what the legislature could not. We have links to the local reporting and more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Open that conversation with this person that you disagree with so much by trying to find the shared value, the thing that you both actually agree about. Challenge yourself to keep bringing it back to the value that we agree on and maybe even the outcome that we wish to see. Go have the tough conversation, because you know what gets better with practice? Those tough conversations.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Maggie Dawn.
Do you know that Donald Trump's draconian policies are hurting children right here in Wisconsin? Dane County's Head Start program experiences outages. We discuss at 3 o'clock.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We return you now to the Civic Media Spotlight, and featured next is Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Pat welcomed on Chris Thiel, legislative specialist for the Milwaukee Public Schools. They chat about the race for state superintendent of public instruction and the issue of raising the bar on standardized tests.
We are back now on Up North News Radio, and we are talking again with Chris Thiel, legislative policy specialist for Milwaukee Public Schools. And this time around, we want to talk about testing in schools around Wisconsin, standards, labels, changes, and also hopefully helping some folks connect the dots, because you can't just talk about test scores in a vacuum, especially when you see what has happened in Madison over the past 15 years or so. Chris Thiel, hello. Thanks for joining us again. How are you?
Morning, Pat. Good. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you again for being part of this. Before I forget, let me let folks know that even before we begin this discussion, that I will be talking tomorrow at this time live with State Superintendent Jill Underley, and then the next day, Wednesday, at 7:05 with Jeff Wright, who's running for State Superintendent, and we are still waiting on Brittany Kinzer to get back to us. So candidate interviews to come, but we really wanted to get at this issue that has become somewhat central to the race for State Superintendent of Public Instruction. So we're going to talk about test scores, the standards, the changes that have taken place, and we're going to get to the root causes. So let's start with the test scores, Chris. Can you tell folks, what are these test scores that are being talked about, these standardized tests that are given? This is just an elementary school, is that right?
It's actually elementary and into K-12. And so, okay. I guess the history of this, the recent history, maybe looking back over the last 25 years, kind of was coming more to prominence with the No Child Left Behind Act. I think people might remember that. That was at the federal level. And at the time, this Congress passes, but President Bush was the president at the time, and we had No Child Left Behind. And that law, that federal law, said we were going to get to a standard where we're going to have 100% of students across the country be proficient. Which is not a bad thing, right? If we could have 100% proficiency amongst all of our students, that would be great. And at the time, the federal government was promising to give students with disabilities, 40% reimbursement. But they were really given, 11 or 12%. And they said, we're going to help kids in poverty with a program called Title I. And, we're only going to give you this much money. And people said, okay, so if we're going to raise this bar, I mean, essentially, this story is there's a long history, Pat, of setting the bar, but forgetting about the most important part, which is how are we going to help kids get there? And so when you questioned No Child Left Behind and said, are we putting enough resources in there? At the time, the president kind of not so subtly suggested you might be a bigot. He would describe the soft bigotry of low expectations was his phrase.
Right.
But nobody was saying we can't get kids to that level. People were just saying we have to put resources in place. So that's kind of, in recent history where that started. Then to bring it down kind of to the state level, after about 10 years of that, when funding did not, wasn't put in place and people realized we weren't getting to that 100% bar, the federal government changed its policy, but said to the states, you need to take a look at where you have set your proficiency bar and put it at a higher level. The thing that I think is really interesting between that federal conversation and that state level conversation is there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that demands that students be provided a sound basic education. But there is something in the Wisconsin state constitution that demands that students be provided a sound basic education. So the federal level, you can say whatever you want where you set the bar. But at the state level, when you set the bar, the law actually says you have to give students the opportunity to be proficient to wherever you set that bar. So in 2011, kind of in this exchange between the federal government and the state government, there was a lot of other things going on. As you may recall, we had Act 10. We had significant state budget cuts happening. And right in that same moment, the thing that kind of gets forgotten in the middle of all that is overnight, and there are newspaper articles to this effect, the adults in the state raised the bar for what it means to be proficient. So, 40, 50% of kids who were proficient on a Tuesday were not proficient on a Wednesday. And you would think, okay, we're going to raise the bar. Let's have all our kids be successful at this higher level. That you would then increase funding for students to get them there. But in 2011, as you know, we actually cut funding. So we raised the bar, but cut the funding. And that obviously just doesn't make any sense. And so here we are again, 15 years on, talking about, you know, where the bar is going to be set, when the major part of the conversation needs to be, okay, but are we going to give our kids the resources to get them to where we want them to be?
So the test that is being discussed here, one of them is called the Forward Exam, and the Forward Exam is given every spring, and there had been one set of labels, advanced, proficient, basic, below basic. There was some changes made in the testing, new labels, which were now advanced, meeting, approaching, and developing. And the complaint seems to be that the previous scores that told you where you were on one of those labels aligned with a national standard called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, whereas these new standards are essentially Wisconsin only. Now, Wisconsin's not the only state that has kind of put some separation between itself and the national standard. But the question, Chris, then becomes, you know, why was it done? And is it done for the betterment of students and better measurement of Wisconsin education quality?
I think the quick answer to that is yes, in a non-politicized context. As you mentioned, there are other states across the country who, if you have different tests, if you have different assessment systems, things get updated, and there is a regular process by which assessments get updated and, you know, where we place these scores. And there are people who are deeply knowledgeable about this work called psychometricians, and they get into the deep math of, you know, how we should, if you have a new test, how should you, you know, change where the proficiency bar is relative to that new test. And there's a lot of nuanced work that goes into that. But I think what's happened and what you're seeing is this is getting boiled down to the phrase that we're lowering the standards or, you know, changing the cut score. So, you know, I think DPI has tried to explain their reasons for why they've made the adjustments. You've seen the reaction. And again, we want to, you know, have the legislature take on the responsibility of setting the cut scores. It is the legislature that by state law in the Constitution also has a responsibility for giving students the opportunity to be proficient. And in a state where we've not had per pupil funding keep pace with inflation for 16 years, we are last or close to last in the nation in supporting students challenged with disabilities. We don't have a policy to support students challenged by poverty, which actually the Vincent First Voigt decision in the state of Wisconsin called for back in 2001. It's fine to set the bar wherever we want, but it's not, it's kind of like, Pat, say you had a neighbor and they said, we're going to have this new standard. We're going to feed our kids three times a day, right? This is our new policy. You went out, you bragged to your neighbor. We get up three times a day. We're going to feed them breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's our policy. And then you said to your neighbor, okay, well, how much did you budget for that? And they said, well, we only budgeted for breakfast. Well, okay. So you can set your food standard of three times a day, but if you're not going to fund it, you know, what does it really mean? So, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, we've talked about two-thirds funding in our state funding system, but you always have to ask two-thirds of what, right?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. And so now for those who might be hearing this and saying, well, are they just making excuses because there's, you know, state funding hasn't kept up with inflation, state funding has been practically hostile toward public education, and so you're lowering your own standards as a result? I it was you or somebody else that put it a bit more clearly. We have seen the purposeful underfunding of public education over the years and unfunded mandates. And I'm not the only one who thinks that there's more to it than that, that some folks in Madison are trying to pave the way to privatization and giving so much of our tax dollars now to the voucher school system that I think that what we're doing with the test scores, again, I don't recall if this was your phrase or somebody else, but this is high stakes accountability. And if there's high stakes accountability, then you'd better attach a fiscal note to it so that people know that, you know, these dots, nobody's forcing those dots to connect. They just do connect.
Yeah, I think, I mean, at this point in the history of Wisconsin, and as you bring the voucher concept into it, we've seen a long history of people who've advocated voucher policy also fighting against private schools having to take similar assessments. And so that ends up being part of this conversation. If these assessments, these standards are going to be put out there for public schools, doesn't it make sense that these same standards should be put out there for private schools that are receiving public money? And I think people agree with that. And again, this is, you know, it's also kind of not a partisan issue. You go back to the Blue Ribbon Commission report from 5-6 years ago that the state legislature looked into K-12 funding, and they recommended to themselves, Republicans and Democrats, that they provide more funding for students with disabilities, that they at least have funding that keeps pace with inflation, that they do some of the basic, that they actually put money to support kids who are challenged by poverty all over the state. These were the recommendations that legislators made to themselves, and they've never funded those recommendations. So, I think we want high standards for our kids, but then I think we really have to talk about the fact that if we want those high standards as the responsible adults, we are obligated to provide our kids the resources to get them there.
So as important as an election might be for state superintendent of public instruction, is it more a case for voters, if they want to keep their eye on the ball, the eye on the ball should be who their legislators are and who ultimately carries all these things through? Because your state legislator holds more sway in terms of the resources for education than any state superintendent. And I'm not meaning to dismiss the significance of that role, but I think a lot of people are going to try to put all of this into the state superintendent race, and that just ain't necessarily so.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something to that. I mean, obviously, it's an independent officer, the state superintendent, and has been very important in the history of our state. But it is interesting that the report cards we have today were created by the state legislature. They're in state law. It's not like a state superintendent waves a wand and creates those things. So whether it's the funding and after, you know, when President Obama was in office, there was a lot of controversy about what test should we give our kids. There was this phrase, Common Core, was hotly debated, and people called it Obama Core. And so we went from having a Ford exam to a Badger exam to a name it after something else in Wisconsin exam. There was just this level of inconsistency because it became so politicized. So the state superintendent, you know, has a lot of responsibility, absolutely. But I do agree with you that, you know, making sure that people are talking to their legislators about what they're, I mean, you know, January 6th, wasn't that, or I think it was January 6th when people took the oath of office in Wisconsin here again. Mm-hmm. And they made an oath to uphold the state constitution. The state constitution said you have to provide a sound basic education and give kids the opportunity to be proficient. And if we're not supporting our kids with the resources, we're not living up to the Constitution, and that is a conversation for the legislature.
And by the way, those legislators are having that conversation with a $4 billion surplus. And I say it as much as I do with that emphasis as a legislator who had to deal with a $6 billion shortfall. I don't have any attitude with the current legislative leadership other than you guys got a good set of resources to work with to make it a win-win for schools and taxpayers and everybody else. Get to work. Chris Thiel giving us some great background about it as legislative specialist for Milwaukee Public Schools. Chris, again, I thank you so much for giving us background on such an important topic.
Thank you, Pat.
We will be back with more after this. This is Up North News Radio from Chippewa Falls on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow is affiliated with the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on select Civic Media stations weekday mornings from 6 until 8. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
America is kept safe because the Army National Guard responds, protects, and supports our nation when it needs them most. From fighting wildfires with air support, helping civilians in flooded neighborhoods, to delivering food and supplies to those who have lost everything, the Army National Guard always responds when disaster strikes. The Army National Guard also trains to be ever vigilant against threats, foreign and domestic. They protect our skies with missile defense weaponry. They secure our information, communications, and infrastructure with cybersecurity. And they protect us against chemical, biological, and radiological hazards with the civilian support team. The Army National Guard also stands ready to deploy and provide support for conflicts or humanitarian missions abroad. Join the Army National Guard and be there to respond, protect, and support your community and your country. Visit NationalGuard.com to learn more about part-time service. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
From De Pere to Suamico, 97.9 WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Wrapping up hour one of this week's Civic Media Spotlight, it's time to laugh. We go to Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, who welcomed on this week Eli Wills, a stand-up comedian. He shares his background in stand-up and talks about the newsletter he runs for a comedy production group called Silly Street Comedy.
I am a Civil War reenactor, but I'm just a Civil War reenactor for how it happened in Wisconsin. So I just like to get dressed up, smoke a pipe, and wait for word from the front.
That is the comedy of Eli Wills, who is my guest here on Nightlight. He is Madison-based, and he also does a comedy newsletter called Silly Street and produces a monthly, once-a-month comedy show at the Working Draft Beer Company. The next show will be on February, is it 13th or 15th? Eli.
13th. I think we're before the 13th, whatever the Thursday okay. before.
And Olivia Witt will be there. So that sounds like fun show. So let's talk about, you've been to several comedy. I'm kind of surprised. Like, you've only been doing this 4 years and you've got quite a few things. You're it seems like you pretty much eat, sleep, and breathe comedy, like whether it's stand up, sketch, improv, writing this newsletter, producing shows. What do you like doing better, producing comedy shows and bringing other people into the fold, or actually performing?
Oh, I love performing. I love producing. I love all of it, or else I wouldn't do all of it. I would say people always, the thing that's weird is I always get more nervous producing than I do performing. I think producing, you want, obviously you want everybody to put on a good show. You want everything to go great. There's no more nerve-wracking feeling than, you know, the 45 minutes before a show and the seats aren't quite as full as you want them to be. And you're hoping, you know, ticket sales aren't quite what you wanted to do. And you're hoping the people turn up because, you know, you're putting yourself out there, you know, doing stand-up. You know, these are jokes I've written. This is stuff I'm confident in. You got to be confident in the strangers to put butts in the seats, and that always makes me nervous. I want people to, if they pay money for a show, I want to make sure they have a good show. So
that's really interesting, and you're right. If the comics don't do well, that is a reflection on you, or if you have a heckler or someone who gives a comedian that maybe is a friend of yours a hard time, that's kind of a reflection on you. You're kind of like the middleman there in a way. I understand how that could be nerve-wracking. Talk about, you just said before you went to the Montreal, was it the Montreal Sketch Fest?
Oh, Toronto.
Toronto
Sketch Fest. Yeah.
What's that like? For people who haven't been to a comedy festival, what's that experience like?
Well, listen, it's a little bit like, you know, summer camp for comics is the way that I always like to joke about it, because it is this situation where you've got all of these venues all around town. Usually there's a bunch of comics in town who are kind of bouncing around to all of these different shows. And it typically what people do is it's good for networking, but it's a great way to kind of get your name out there in venues, particularly people in my stage of my career where, you know, I don't have a ton of, you know, legit fans who are coming to sell out stadiums in, you know, Toronto, Canada for me. It's a great way to kind of get out and meet people and meet producers and meet comics from these other areas throughout the country. Because like you said, I'm sure when you started in Chicago, the stage time is there in Chicago to stay siloed, but you meet all the same people doing all the same thing. It's a great way to go and meet other people throughout the country.
It is. And I'll tell you, I was the only comedy festival I was ever at. I was invited to the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. I was a new face in 1997. Yeah. New face to everybody else, at least. And there was
Dude, I'm always so surprised those new faces. It's always guys who've been doing it forever. They're like, who's the new faces? And I'm like, yeah. So this new guy I just found out is a 15-year vet of the industry.
Well, that's pretty much how it was. But like when you get up there, you know, there's all this pressure going in where people on the flight up and then on the van from the airport to the hotel in a city you've never been to before. And you've got these managers saying, oh, you'll definitely get a development deal. This is the place when you're. And like there was 30 new faces and two or three guys got development deals and the rest of us got like, you know, 5 to 10 business cards from potential managers, you know. So it was a good experience, but that's nerve wracking too. Do you get nervous before you go up when something is at stake? Like you said before, you don't really get that nervous when you go on stage, or you're more nervous when you're producing something. But what's it like when there's something really at stake for you as a comedian?
Yeah, I mean, that's when the nerves really happen, because just to put it in context, I'm also a member of Atlas Improv Company, which is a place I do shows at, you know, 4 times a weekend. I'm at Comedy on State all the time. Those venues, when you're at them, you do it all the time. You kind of, you know, you have the normal stage nerves, but you're in your element. These are places that you're used to performing at, and you can kind of go and crush it and do your thing.
Yeah.
It's when you get into those, you know, you're on, you know, you're going to a venue in, you know, a new city that you've never been to before. You're trying to, for the most time, someone has booked you off of like a clip. So they've seen you online, but they might not have met you or seen you in person, which is clearly a totally different experience for how you take in comedy. So you want to make sure that you're like, you're almost nervous of being like, you took a chance on me. I want to make sure you didn't screw up. I don't want you to, I don't want you to look like an idiot. Like you made a dumb decision for booking me. I did a festival in Bozeman, Montana. And after the first night, one of the guys that booked me was like, hey, no one else on this festival wanted to book you, but I put my, you know, I wanted to book you. I was the one who put my thumb on the scale to get you on. And I was like, you didn't need to tell me that, man. Like I, you know, now I'm super nervous that if I screw this up, they're going to think you have bad taste. Like,
it could just be a humble brag too, or something. We've got a text here from the 608. Anna says, Pete, Eli is mentioned in the January 2025 issue of Madison Magazine about the Madison comedy scene. He is mentioned as one of 6 Madison indie producers. Hey, that's pretty cool. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that was really awesome. It's one of those things where I didn't actually know it was happening until I kind of heard it was getting published, because I think they, you know, they limited resources on how many folks they actually get to interview. And so what was really validating about that process is like what that means is that my other comics who were interviewed in that article had to have put my name up as a person that was worth mentioning. I thought that was that was super cool, because it's just really validating, you know, a lot of the local comedy process can be, you know, thankless, especially a lot of these producers. You're working with bars, you're working with venues, you're entertaining drunks a lot of the times. You can grind really hard for limited results. And so what that meant to me was like, hey, there's a lot of people in this scene doing great work, and they think I'm doing great work as well. So I really appreciated that write-up. That was really, really sweet.
That's awesome. And thank you for the text, Anna. Eli, can you stick around through the news for a few minutes?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it.
All right. We're going to talk to Eli about the improv scene in Madison, which I know even less about. He just mentioned Atlas Improv, and then he also saw The Brutalist. I want to ask him about that. That's coming up next on Nightlight after Civic Media's award-winning news team tells you what's up. This is Pete Schwab at Nightlight on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's too late to turn back now. I believe I'm falling in love. I found myself phoning her at least 10 times a day. You know, it's so
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekdays from 6 until 8 p.m. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the web.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matinee on Air.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On Monday's show, Joel Klicka, the creator of Outdoor Movement and Connections, stops in our studio.
And a fan favorite of our Heights Pub and Parlor music series returns to tell us about their upcoming event at the Epic Center.
Join us.
Weekday mornings, 6 till 9.
Imagine home. The smell of coffee, the sound of a lawnmower, the sun's warmth on your face. Free to be yourself. surrounded by love that helps you grow. This is a place to call home. That's an American dream we all deserve. But in 50% of U.S. states, you could legally be denied housing if you are LGBTQ+. Get the facts and hear real stories at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Doge locked out.
The federal judge is temporarily restricting the access that Elon Musk's team has to Treasury Department data and payment systems, saying that this could cause irreparable harm and that it could also increase the likelihood of hacks and leaks.
ABC Selena Wang and a federal judge blocking the Trump administration's plan to put thousands of workers at USAID on leave and reinstating hundreds who've already been removed. The bodies of those on a passenger plane that went missing in Alaska now found on sea ice, along with the wreckage of the plane about 34 miles southeast of Nome, where it was supposed to land. All 10 people on board died. In Tel Aviv, 56-year-old Ohad Ben-Ami. That's the sound of him returning with his family. They were happy at a hospital, part of the latest hostage exchange. One of three released by Hamas. As part of the deal, Israel releasing 183 Palestinian prisoners. This is ABC News.